This is Richard Tarnas, October 26, 2007. It's entitled Cosmos and Psyche, Jungian Archetypes, Synchronicity, and Astrology. This was recorded on DVD at Antioch University.
Okay, so welcome tonight, and I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the Jung Society. I know some of you don't know very much about it. At the break, please come and ask me or one of the people who are at the front desk about the Jung Society. We have information about it, and we also have a website, jungseattle.org, that you can go and check out all of our programs. We meet once a month and have lectures and workshops oriented around the work of CGU.
So, to introduce Richard Tarnas, perhaps the best thing that I can say is a recommendation given to me by a student last night when, after Richard gave his lecture on At the Threshold of a New Worldview, and she came up to me and she said, "It's blowing my mind." And every teacher loves to hear that, because that means breakthroughs are happening, right? And at least for the last 10, 15 years, it's by far the best History of Ideas book. And as I mentioned in an earlier introduction, the key to this book is it's not just a great book, sort of piecemeal thing. There is a meta-narrative moving through it that's highly significant for our time, and it really brings the old ideas to life. And then Cosmos and Psyche, another incredible book having to do with the astrological correspondences that are a part of this introduction to a worldview. So that's what we'll be hearing about tonight. So for tonight, the topic is Cosmos and Psyche, Jungian Archetypes, Synchronicity, and Astrology. So Richard is the Professor of Philosophy and Cultural History at the California Institute of Integral Studies, where he founded a graduate program in Psychology, Cosmology, and Consciousness. He teaches Archetypal Studies and Depth Psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, and is the author of the two aforementioned books. I should mention that Cosmos and Psyche received the Book of the Year Prize from the Scientific and Medical Network in England. So it's truly a pleasure to introduce to you Richard Park.
Thank you very much for that generous introduction, Andy, and to those here, starting with, well, Connie, who's not here, who I got the first email from many months ago to come here, and then since then, Shirley and the Jung Society graciously inviting me and setting up things, and then Antioch for hosting me overall here, and three of the events happening in their quarters here. Since tonight is about, in a way, a kind of scandal, let me start with a great protagonist of scandals, George Bernard Shaw. I was always admiring of his ability to take situations that he would be put in, and to even in the most challenging moments, he could sit standing, thinking on his feet, turn that situation into something that was elevating for everybody involved, rather than the opposite. And in particular, I'm thinking of, he had gone a number of years, you know, he made his, he kind of forged himself doing soapbox speaking at Hyde Park in London, and dealing with, you know, he was putting out pretty radical ideas and handling the debate, and no doubt the hecklers, and probably getting certain characteristic abilities to handle that kind of thing in on the street, so to speak. Then he started writing plays after writing criticism for a while, dramatic theater criticism, and remember he said something like, I've been saying that there's a new form of theater that is arising, and finally I decided I better write it myself. He wrote a number of plays that were minimal success, and then finally one that was very successful, Arms and the Man. And the opening night, it was a terrific response in the audience. A lot of the greats were in the audience, like William Butler Yeats and Oscar Wilde. And it was the 1890s. And there were, in the applause, there were cries of author, author. So Shaw starts walking up on stage after the play with the all the applause. And then as the applause is dying down, there was heard from the balcony one loud, long boo. And Shaw, without really skipping a beat, he looked up at the balcony and said, "I quite agree with you, my dear fellow, but what can the two of us do against so many?" And he could just, the way he could take that deflation, deflating situation, and then, you know, elevate, he was a master at it. One time he, you know, I've been signing a lot of books since Cosmos and Psyche came out, and reminded of how when one day he was in a used bookstore, and he came upon one of his own books that he had actually inscribed to a friend. And so he bought the book back from the used bookseller and crossed out the old inscription, which had said, "To so-and-so, with great esteem, George Bernard Shaw." He crossed it out and wrote, "To so-and-so, with even greater esteem." So I bring up Shaw because, like Shaw, Jung was willing to cross the line. He was, actually they were contemporaries, Shaw an older contemporary, both long-lived, and both were willing to push the envelope, push the boundaries in order to bring about a transformation in their society. And I want to begin tonight with a passage that Jung wrote in his later years. This is from Memories, Dreams, Reflections, his wonderful autobiography. I was reflecting last night on how many great works he wrote. If you just look at from after he was age 70, everything that he wrote, like On the Nature of the Psyche, which is his greatest sort of over theoretical work, and then Synchronicity and A Causal Connecting Principle, and Answer to Job, this great prophetic religious work, and Memories, Dreams, Reflections. He's already in his early 80s. Ion, Mysterium Conjunctionis. It's a phenomenal creativity that's coming through at that point. And if you look at a lot of the other great depth psychologists, we see similar lucidity and creativity well into the 70s and 80s of their life. I mean, James Hillman now, sharp as can be as ever. He's now 81. Stan Grof is 76. Still, we co-teach. He's still just as wonderfully insightful and comprehensive as ever. Freud lived to be, he was 83 when he wrote that final masterpiece, An Outline of Psychoanalysis, that kind of condenses into 70 pages his whole life work. The Joseph Campbell interviews that everyone saw with Bill Moyers. He was 83 years old at that point. Marie-Louise von Franz, right, very. Also, Marianne Woodman. So there may be something about depth psychology that is good for the body and the mind as well as the soul. Good for us to keep in mind for those of us who are approaching those decades. So this is Jung from Memories, Dreams, Reflections from a chapter called Late Thoughts. Isn't that a great title for a man like Jung? In his 80s, writing a chapter called Late Thoughts. So this feels very sort of portentous and pregnant with depth of meaning. And the passage, this will be chapter 10, verses 8 to 12. It's a joke. Jungian societies and institutes can be a little bit biblical in their appreciation of young Saint Carl. Our psyche is set up in accord with the structure of the universe, and what happens in the macrocosm likewise happens in the infinitesimal and most subjective reaches of the psyche. Our psyche is set up in accord with the structure of the universe, and what happens in the macrocosm likewise happens in the infinitesimal and most subjective reaches of the psyche. This is a bold thought, this connecting of cosmos and psyche of our cosmology with our psychology. That's one thing, just in terms of our, like, say, philosophy of science. We know the extent to which our paradigms, our scientific paradigms, will be saturated by the cultural zeitgeist of the time, which in turn will reflect the psychological mood of that culture in that time in history. So just even good philosophy of science points to the extent to which our understanding of the world is shaped by our psychological structures, presuppositions, and so forth. But it's another thing to take it to the step that Jung has there, where he's saying that it also works the other way around, where the very structures of the cosmos, the deep structures, are in some sense parallel to, coherent with, and relevant to understanding the deep structures of the human psyche, and that there's a kind of macrocosmic, microcosmic correspondence. And this is a man who had been working within hermetic, esoteric, alchemical, and astrological worldviews for, at this point, 50, 60 years. And let's see, at that point, it was about 60 years, yeah, certainly 50 years. So he, that statement of that underlying unity reflects a lot of experience, and I have to say that when I first read it, I did not have any guess as to how deeply it was valid. And I'll try to unpack a little bit how I now believe this Jung's insight has validity in the most concrete and extraordinary way. Jung, since this is the Jung Society, I want to say a couple words about Jung as all the different hats he wore. He's a pretty remarkable person in this way. He's a very complex figure. On the one hand, there's Jung the physician, the healer. And from that point of view, he was very pragmatic. He was interested in what would work, what would heal people. There's also Jung the scientist, the empiricist. He would often call himself an empiricist. And he was an empiricist of the psyche, of the unconscious. Even the way he finally wrote about synchronicities many years late in his career, he did it as an empiricist. It was important to him that he could identify himself that way, because he recognized that the center of gravity within the modern worldview was being defined by modern science, and he was loyal to the modern scientific persona and perspective. But there was also Jung the philosopher. Even when he said, "Okay, I'm not a metaphysician, I don't do metaphysics," he'd always be quoting Kant, but then he'd always go ahead and do exactly what he said he wasn't going to do, set out statements that clearly had enormous metaphysical import. And this kept him in a kind of self-contradictory, inconsistent place, especially as the years kept going by, and he had more and more data, more and more concepts that couldn't be fit into the Kantian framework that he kept alluding to as being the philosophical structure that we need to stay within. So it's given a great deal of ground for people to, for scholars to reflect on and say, well, this is what Jung said here, but then look at what he said here. And depending on what axe one is grinding, one can quote Jung to support any of these different positions. Jung was also a man of religion. This is Jung the Gnostic, Jung the spiritual seeker, the mystic, the prophet, and really the answer to Job is so, I mean, it's almost, it's so prophetic. It's like a, in the Hebrew tradition, I mean, he's kind of like the, and many people look at answer to Job as being like a kind of new dispensation, to use the term that Edinger used about it. And it's like a new... Jung was both a rebel against Christianity, and in the same way that each of the Hebrew prophets were great rebels against Judaism as well as reformers of it, so was Jung within the Judaic and Christian stream. And then there's Jung the writer, as Murray Stein has explored. There's Jung the teacher and the lecturer, Jung the pastor and the preacher of sermons, keeping up his family tradition. Then there's Jung the parapsychologist, who was interested in the anomalies, the odd phenomenon, the heresies. He was actually called a heretic at his funeral by the minister who was, Hillman mentioned that, who was at the funeral. He was actually called a heretic. Of course, Hillman loves that part of Jung, because Hillman is the heretic within the Jungian stream, and he celebrates that part of Jung who was just consistently heretical and interested in the thing that didn't, that that didn't fit the orthodoxy, that didn't fit our expectations. In fact, Jung's definition of the divine was that which constantly trips one up as one is going along the path. The divine is the one that stops one up short. Remember, on top of his door, those of you who've been in Switzerland and have gone by his home, where his grandson still lives now, on Lake Zurich in Kusnacht, there's a like a above the door, written in stone, is this saying that Jung took from the ancients. In Latin, it's vocatus atque non vocatus deus ad erit, namely, called or not called, God will be present, or God will come, or called or not called, the God will be present. See, it's ambiguous. Deus, it could be the God in a kind of pagan way, or God in a kind of monotheistic way. It's got that perfect ambiguity which Jung thrived on. And then finally there's Jung, the esotericist, interested in all these completely marginalized esoteric traditions like alchemy and hermeticism, the I Ching coming in from China, and astrology. Now, I gave a lecture in Switzerland in 2000 in Lucerne, at the end of which a woman came up to me, a psychiatrist who was at that point in her later 70s, I would guess. And she had known, she was a friend of the Jung family, she was quite close to Jung's daughter, Gret Bellman Jung. And she mentioned to me after my lecture that she had, when she was in medical school, she had asked Jung what was his relationship to astrology. How do you view it? And he said, that's a deep topic, and we should talk about it. We'll discuss it some afternoon in the garden. So she came, and he said, he told her at that point that, this is in the 1950s, that he was using astrology with all of his patients at that point in order to shine a light on both using the birth chart as well as the transits to shine a light on the archetypal dynamics that were unique to that person and also their timing, the unfolding, the activation of the different archetypal complexes. And Jung's daughter, who many of you know, became an astrologer. Much like Hillman's son became an astrologer, Jung's daughter did. And in particular, Jung's daughter did in order to provide her father with the technical information that he needed in order to do the analyses, because he, back then, didn't have what everybody's got available now, the computers. You can just in 5 seconds get a person's birth chart or transits. When I was learning 30 plus years ago, we had to do everything by hand, and certainly that was the case 30 years before that when Jung, that's amazing that it's halfway back to that point, they had to do everything, there's many calculations that go into each birth chart, and so Jung's daughter did that. Now Jung was so into it, and yet while he would write fairly often about astrology, he would often say things. He never revealed the full extent to which he never published anything in a public way about the full extent to which he was employing astrology. You can certainly see it, read between the lines. You can see the extraordinary intensity with which he was focused on studying astrology at the time of when he wrote Synchronicity and A Causal Connecting Principle, where he does that astrology experiment. I read a letter that synchronistically he wrote on the day I was born in Switzerland. I was born in Switzerland myself, and he wrote this on the day I was born, February 21st, 1950, to a scientist talking about how completely focused he was on studying this astrological research for the synchronicity essay that he was now in the process of writing. So he's really deeply into it. But in terms of his larger statements about it, you really have to look at his letters or hear from his family or friends to get the extent to which he was involved. And I think it's for very good strategic reasons that he did not publicize the extent to which he was into it. And I think it was also, to a great extent, Jungians, the next generation of Jungians, did not follow that path, certainly publicly. They did not, many Jungian analysts are quite, they know a lot about certainly the astrological archetypes, and they know their birth chart, but it is by no means an essential part of the Jungian analytic persona or contemporary practice. And again, I think that was for very, very good reason. Astrology is the gold standard of superstition in our culture today, and has been for about 200 years. And for Jungians to have deeply associated themselves with astrology at the time that they were already in a heavy-duty conflict with psychoanalysis, and Jungians could easily, and psychoanalysts would have just had a heyday. They already were saying Jung was an ambulatory schizophrenic with mystical delusions. But if he was also an astrologer, then that would have been the end of the story. So I think it was quite wise that he didn't do it. And James Hillman has told me, or he told me many years ago, in 1980, he said that when he was in Zurich in the 1950s, he was studying astrology in the closet, because even though Jung himself was totally into it, nobody else was, and he felt he needed to do this in a kind of private literally esoteric way. And I think the reason that this is the case has to do with a deeper and larger worldview situation, cosmological, metaphysical context within which Jung's entire life work needs to be understood. Jung was working within and against and through the modern worldview that emerged in after the Scientific Revolution, the Enlightenment, 17th, 18th century, fully established and ratified in the course of the 19th century with Darwin and so forth. And this was basically a disenchanted worldview. I mean, the cosmos, the universe, was seen as being basically randomly evolving matter and energy that had accidentally brought forth a sufficiently complex organism that had somehow gotten consciousness, and that along with consciousness came spiritual aspirations, aesthetic values, a moral sensibility, and this was all these were basically human realities in a cosmos, a world that was seen as being basically a world of objects, and the human being was a subject. And the world outside of the human being did not have subjectivity. It did not have a capacity for caring meaning and purpose. It was basically the bottom line was randomness, and then order was what needed to be explained. David Bohm has taken issue with this, pointing out if we have that assumption, all sorts of things can't register within our scientific purview, and our net basically misses all sorts of subtle forms of order. And he suggests it may make more sense, particularly with so much research that has come up in the last half century, to assume order and then explain randomness. But that's Bohm and coming more out of physics. But in terms of Jung's journey, he was constantly dealing with this this incredibly rich interior life in himself and in his patients. Many people having these extraordinary religious experiences, dreams. He was familiar with the great literature of mysticism. He had experiences himself of truly numinous character, transpersonal dimensions of being. But working within the disenchanted modern worldview, this is why Kant was so important to him. He said, well, we don't really know what the nature of the world is. All we can say is empirically, the human psyche has these kinds of experiences, and whether or not God exists, or the anima mundi, or archetypal figures, we do know that psychologically they are real. There is an inner empiricism that we can be very definitive about, but we can't break out of the bubble of our subjectivity. Our interiority saturates everything that we think we know. And really, even the scientist, the most rigorous scientist, needs to recognize, and here he even drew on Karl Popper. This is something about Jung. Jung was already reading Karl Popper in the 1930s and 40s. Major philosopher of science, really Popper and Thomas Kuhn are the major philosophers of science of the 20th century, in kind of revealing the extent to which our scientific presuppositions govern our capacity to register test data and gives a whole, basically sets the stage for the postmodern understanding of all human knowledge, that it's always interpretive. So anyway, impressively, Jung was even reading Popper in the German back in the 30s and 40s before he was really become well known in say the Anglo-American philosophical and scientific world. So Jung, if I could just make a quick drawing here, let's. If I were to describe the world that Jung was working within, he's got this. Here's the world view, and the human being is here with, if I draw diagonal lines, this would be like, this is the self, this is the human psyche, this is the world of human experience subjectively, and the diagonal lines represent where conscious intelligence exists in the world, where spirit and soul, however one defines it, where the capacity for meaning and purpose and value exists. The world as a whole is voided of void of meaning and purpose. I shared last night that famous passage from Steven Weinberg, the cosmologist, at the end of the first 3 minutes, his overview of modern cosmology. He says the more the universe is comprehensible, the more pointless it seems to be. And it's just that's the kind of the basic conclusion of mainstream modern physics and biology and so forth, is that there's no intrinsic purpose or meaning. There's no meaning and purpose are human constructs, are human characteristics. Which creates, of course, the modern existentialist condition of being in a stranger in a strange land, a state of endarkenment, as Heidegger called it. Looks a little more like an egg, but that's all right. If we were to contrast this with more like the primal worldview, the self is permeable rather than defined in that Cartesian way, and all meaning and purpose and spirit and soul pervade the whole world and the self, and the human being has a sense of continuity from the inner, his or her own inner world, to the inner world of the cosmos. The cosmos is, and the earth and nature and the forests and the lakes and rivers and the sky, the planets, the sun and moon, they are all saturated with meanings and purposes and the capacity to mean things and to have archetypal significance. When Joseph Campbell would say, as I heard him say 50 times, this sentence, which is actually at the very beginning of Hero with a Thousand Faces, he said, "It would not be too much to say that myth is the secret opening through which the cosmos pours forth its inexhaustible energies into human cultural manifestation." Myth is the secret opening through which the cosmos, pours forth its inexhaustible energies into human cultural manifestation. Now that statement is not a statement of the modern worldview. It's not coming from here. From the modern worldview, if you think you see purpose and meaning in the being conveyed to you by nature with the winds or the way the two eagles cross the horizon at the moment the baby was born, or with the conjunction of the planets or the cycles of the sun and moon, if you think that that's meaningful in some way, if you think that the world is ensouled in that way, then you are projecting human categories or meanings onto the non-human world, and that's seen as being a basic epistemological fallacy, a sign of immature mental development. It needs to be, as I mentioned last night, if you do too much of it, you would be referred to a psychiatrist and probably be medicated. So Campbell's statement really reflects the primal worldview of participatio mystique rather than the modern worldview of a sharp differentiation between subject and object. And Jung was constantly dealing with contradictory. He was getting so much information that was suggesting a more primal worldview, and yet he was loyal to the modern scientific understanding of the universe as not being intrinsically meaningful. And he'd often say things like, it's just, this is the human being's projection onto the heavens, let's say, or onto, he had an experience of the earth as alive at the moment of an earthquake that he experienced. And he later said, well, I can really see how primitives projected onto the earth, this it was like a live animal that suddenly was moving, and I would. So he was negotiating these challenging contradictions between the data and the theory that he had grown up with. And the big breakthrough, and he really was trying to come to terms with synchronicities, which are, as you know, the that occurrence of coincidences, either precisely coincident in time or closely approximate, that are connected by meaning rather than by any linear causation. And he saw this so often in his own life and the lives of others, often happening at times of crucial transformation. They seem to happen most frequently and intensely at moments of, at times of, where there are births happening or deaths or crises. And then eventually they became just very much part of his way of experiencing life, where he's always alert to it, like a shaman or a Chinese sage, like a I Ching kind of sage. He was just always alert to these meaningful coincidences. Now, the philosopher of science, Percy Bridgman, once said, coincidences are what you have left over after you've applied a bad theory. He's exactly right, of course. I mean, like a good theory is able to give a compelling or at least plausible explanation for coincidences, patterns that shouldn't be there if you have a random situation. But the synchronicities that so many people have experienced in their lives, and Jung pointed out how often people keep the most important synchronicities very private to themselves because they don't want to have them ridiculed by others. They're often things that almost no one else could quite grasp how significant, how coincidental, how the force of coincidence is something that is so tailor-made for that particular person that it's very hard to have it register for anybody else. So many of us in this room, I'm sure, have experienced it, and they push us to reconsider this world that we live in and to think, I wonder if it really is so random. It seems like something else is going on here. It's like someone or something is paying attention. There's some orchestrating principle. Jung saw it ultimately as being a manifestation of the self archetype that moves things towards wholeness and renders things meaningful and brings larger underlying orders to consciousness, and that centers us in some way. He often said those synchronicities are regularly a defeat for the ego at the same time that they are a victory for the self. This is the self as a capital of S. Let me give let me ask, by the way, how many of you here, let's see, how many of you here are mainly, you know, here as Jungians or influenced by Jung, informed by Jung, you know Jung well? How many? how many of you here are have been initiated into astrology to some extent or other? About half and half. And an overlapping halves. And then how many of you were here last night? Probably most of you know the kind of paradigm case that Jung used at his last lecture at Eranos. Last lecture at Eranos was 1951, and that's where he set out the synchronicity idea. He'd been working with it for 20 years. He'd used the term for the first time about 1929, but it wasn't until, it was over 20 years before he really felt ready to write a full kind of analysis of it. And there he gave in 51, and then in the Fuller monograph of 1952, he gave the paradigm case was this patient who had been quite resistant to the whole process of psychotherapy with them. She was he said she was gifted with a kind of Cartesian intellect that could kind of reduce anything that was going on to, well, that's nothing more than this, or as a kind of a reductionist skepticism. He said it had a kind of geometrical quality to it, and it was so resistant that he just finally kind of had to let go and just wait for something to happen spontaneously that would kind of break the ice or of the armory. And indeed, this took place one day when she had had a dream, a quite impressive dream, he described it, as she told him about it the next morning. It was a dream in which she had been given a golden scarab as an expensive piece of jewelry. And the golden scarab, Jung, of course, immediately goes to the Egyptian mythologies of death and rebirth, that the scarab is the great symbol for. And as she is describing the dream, there's this tapping at the window. It's kind of insistently, and he finally picks up. He can tell it's some kind of like an insect or something. He opens up the window, and there is a scarab beetle, golden green in color. He picks it up and gives it to her and said, "And here is your scarab." And it had such a shocking, astonishing effect on her. I mean, it so astonished her that as he said, it kind of broke open her resistance. She opened up to the fact that there are more things in heaven and earth than were dreamt of in her philosophy. And he said from that point on, the therapeutic process unfolded very quickly. Now, that's one type of synchronicity where something dramatic happens that has a radical impact on a person. It can be it moves us towards wholeness. As Jung said, we should understand synchronicities in the same way we approach dreams, which is they are, in a sense, signals from the unconscious, from the whole, to the conscious self, the conscious ego, which in its one-sidedness will be blind to many factors. And the dreams or the synchronicities serve as compensatory corrections to that one-sidedness of consciousness. That's why he said it would be a victory for the self while it's a defeat for the ego very often. The self is that, among other things, is pushing us towards individuation in the sense of our flowering as an individual out of a ground that is universal so that we are able to bring into a larger unity the conscious and unconscious rather than have that be split. Now 50 years after synchronicity has been out there as a concept and commented on by many theorists and observers and part of popular culture and so forth, we can see that there's actually several stages that people tend to go through with synchronicities. First, there's these kind of minuscule subtle things that, was that a coincidence or not? I mean, it's a coincidence, but, you know, it could have just happened by chance, and one sort of forgets about it. But then there's often, especially at critical thresholds, there's these big ones that happen that have a catalyzing, awakening effect. And then after there's been that type of almost metaphysical transformation that can take place in the person's worldview, synchronicities don't stop. In fact, they often seem to become more frequent, but they, instead of being overwhelming, they take on more the quality of the artistry of life in some sense, and people become more alert to the patterning of life that is beyond, you know, just randomness, just beyond chance, that is constantly giving us both a kind of greater capacity to live skillfully in harmony with the whole, because the synchronicity is, as it were, representing the rest of the whole as giving a signal to the part, which is our consciousness, our conscious ego, and helping it to come into relationship to the whole in a more confluent way. But there's also a purely aesthetic quality too. It partly helps us live more skillfully, but perhaps they also there's a kind of artistry that one just enjoys and just appreciates in the flow of synchronistic patterning in life once one is alert to it. And finally, there's also that quality of numinosity, of spiritual, a sense of appreciation for the power of whatever spiritual ordering principle there is in life that is able to orchestrate these things. So let me give an example from Jung's life towards the end of his life. He never wrote about this, but in a marvelous little volume of memoirs by people who knew Jung and Emma Jung and Tony Wolf, the three key figures in Jungian psychology in Zurich, this one memoir is by a man who had come to see Jung about whether a book should be published, and the meeting was at 5 o'clock at Jung's house. This is in the 1950s. Jung, they have the meeting, and this publisher has asked this man to get Jung's feedback on and maybe approval of whether a manuscript written by a scientist who had recently died, whether this should be published. And during the discussion, Jung said, no, I don't think it should be published. And as the discussion kept going, it got a little bit sharp at times, and Jung was quite emphatic that it shouldn't be published. And at a certain point, he looked at his watch, and the man named Henry Fiertz, who was writing this memoir, said, well, I assumed that Jung had had enough. He felt that he'd address this problem as long as he cared to, and this was going to be the end of the interview. But instead, Jung, with a slightly puzzled look on his face, said, that's odd. What time do you have? And the man said, 5:35. And what time did we begin? And the man said, well, 5 o'clock, as we'd agreed. Well, he said, my watch says 5 after 5. I just had this watch totally repaired and came back in perfect working condition from the Swiss watch repair. My watch is wrong. Your watch is right. Let us begin again. And he listened to the same arguments and heard them in a totally different way, and just came to the conclusion that the book should be published, which indeed it was, and it became successful. I bring you this because, first, I bring you this vignette partly because it shows how Jung was just constantly alert to synchronicities. He would listen in sessions with in a therapeutic session to like how more charged atmosphere in the consulting room would be reflected in sudden lapping of the waves on the lake just outside the office window, or sudden landing of a flock of birds. There was always this coherence that he was like a shaman, alert to. And he could read the symbolism as easily as other people would read a newspaper. I mean, he got right away that the stoppage of his watch happening right at the same time as he now saw the malfunction of his thinking. His thinking had stopped in the same time that his watch had stopped, and he saw a coherence there. And then this is the crucial thing. He not only could see the pattern, he could also recognize that that meaningful pattern could be carried by the outside world and not just the human inside world. And perhaps especially striking is that he used that information to correct himself. Not like he recognized that he could be wrong, and he corrected his own egoic stance rather than, you know, I mean, most people would first of all say, damn it, I just had this watch fixed. The interview's at an end. But instead, he not only saw the pattern, he used it to transcend his own self-assertion in the world and to correct himself. It's a very telling anecdote, not one that he tells about himself, too. It's something that someone else told, so it's kind of especially meaningful. Well, with that, Jung is breaking out of this. If you have little synchronistic patterns of meaning happening outside your bubble of human consciousness, the world, these shouldn't be happening in a totally random universe. And so he's starting at that point to break out of the Cartesian, Kantian, disenchanted worldview. And really, the whole religious situation of the modern psyche shifts with synchronicity. This is a point that Robert Aziz brilliantly makes in his book on Jung and synchronicity and this Jung psychology of religion. He says this is the most significant part of Jungian psychology for the psychology of religion, because it redefines the instead of the earlier Jungian view that the sacred circle within which the modern religious situation takes place, the vessel of religious experience and transformation and so forth, for Jung in the earlier years was always direct archetypal experience within the inner sanctum of the human psyche. With synchronicities, all of nature and the cosmos becomes the sacred circle within which that the spiritual process of individuation is being supported. It redefines the religious situation. It becomes authentically, you know, holistic in a way that wasn't before. And he also started, therefore, redefining what archetypes were, saying that archetypes are not just the underlying deep structures of the human psyche, the collective psyche, but in some sense the collective psyche seems to be connected with nature itself, and that archetypes inform matter as well as spirit, the world as well as the inner psyche of the human being. And this starts to break down that radical subject-object dichotomy and alienation of the modern condition. Well, astrology, as Jung came to recognize it, in his own words said, is like synchronicity on a grand scale of where the entire cosmos seems to be now the carrier of meaning. And the existence of synchronistic patternings that show a systematic correlation between the archetypal dynamics of human experience and the planetary movements of the solar system against the backdrop of the cosmos, points to a revisioning of not only the nature of the human psyche and its relationship to the cosmos, but it revisions the very nature of our cosmos. It suggests that the archetypes are in some fundamental connection to the planets and the sun and the moon. It suggests further that there is that the Pythagorean Platonic understanding of essentially a some form of universal intelligence or ordering principle that is at work in the cosmos is focused on the Earth in some way, very almost like a kind of hyper transcendence of the Copernican revolution. Well, this was something that I personally did not see as very plausible. I first had an encounter with astrology when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and there was a Harvard Divinity School professor who'd been trained by Jung as a Jungian analyst, whom he taught at the Divinity School, and we had become friends in the years that I was there in Cambridge, and he was actually had been an early at one point the therapist of my girlfriend at Radcliffe, and we would meet and talk about Freud and Jung and European culture and history of ideas. But one day he must have asked me at some point what my birth date was, because one day he came in and started talking to me about what the meanings were of some of my planetary positions, and I thought he'd kind of taken leave of the senses, and that this rather high level of discussion that we had just been suddenly lost, and as quickly as possible, I steered the conversation back to our usual avenues, and didn't go there again. And it's as if astrology kind of knocked on the door, and I'd said, "Are you kidding? And no way." And for several years, I had no further encounter with astrology. And then, after I graduated, I went to Esalen Institute to study with Joseph Campbell and Houston Smith, who we were talking about this morning, and also Stan Grof. And there, Stan Grof and I was doing my doctoral research, and we were working with the problem of trying to understand the tremendous why people went through very powerful transformations, crises, breakthroughs, and so forth, spiritual emergencies at different times in their life, the unpredictability of it, and particularly Stan Grof, who had been still is sort of the master psychotherapist using LSD and other substances, and he was in Prague, and then the National Institute of Mental Health program in Maryland in the 60s and the 70s. All those psychiatrists that for years tried to, and those of you who have done any kind of psychedelic exploration know the tremendous variability that these substances have, and that you can't predict whether it is going to be. One person, particularly with LSD, something like MDMA, like ecstasy, that there's a kind of bias towards positive experiences. But with LSD, same exact substance, same chemical, same number of micrograms, same setting, and yet one person could have the most spiritually ecstatic experience of their life, and another person could have a terrifying sort of psychotic nightmare, or the same person at different times could have those radically different experiences. And no traditional psychological test was like the MMPI, the Rorschach, the TAT, were of any value in predicting which way a person would experience it. And when we were at Esalen, Esalen was a place where so many, like both ancient and esoteric and Asian mystical ideas, as well as new kind of cutting-edge postmodern ideas were being both discussed and explored, but practiced and with honor, as it were. In a way, the inner life of mental life of Jung in the 1950s kind of resembled the whole Esalen community's mental life, you know, in that kind of Gnostic, esoteric fantasia that was must have been part of Jung's inner world. How many of you have seen Bergman's great film, Wild Strawberries? I highly recommend. I mean, of course, Bergman is, you know, Ingmar Bergman, the Swedish, is, you know, at the summit of our of the great film directors. And Seventh Seal and Wild Strawberries are he does these two right in basically 1 year. Many people consider Seventh Seal to be the greatest film ever made. It's certainly completely, just totally archetypal. But then, less than 1 year later, he brings out Wild Strawberries, this magnificent film. Anyway, since you haven't seen, when you see it, the opening scene, it looks, you will certainly, I think, those of you who know Jung and all the photographs of Jung in his later years, it looks just like Jung at the library, in the library, writing, surrounded by his books. And well, we thought, since none of the, Stan and I thought, since none of these other methods had worked, we should maybe explore this astrological perspective, even though we consider it to be the least plausible of all the esoteric systems. If you've done a lot of meditation and inner journeying and psychedelic exploration, there aren't too many new paradigm perspectives or ancient esoteric and mystical perspectives that you don't take seriously. The universe is a many-splendored thing. But astrology seems still the most implausible. But someone showed us how to calculate charts and how to calculate transits and gave us some textbooks of like what kinds of experiences tend to occur under this transit of, say, Saturn trine the Sun or Pluto conjoining the Moon or whatever it happened to be. And both Stan and I had very good records of all of our own personal sessions, and we also did had a huge database of his other patients over the years. And so we did the calculations, looked at the archetypal principles that were supposedly going to be most prominent at the time that people, including ourselves, were doing these sessions, and the precision of correlation between the two sets of data, on the one hand the experiences, and on the other the planetary positions, was so extraordinary and so consistent that we were mind blown. This most, you know, this gold standard of superstition was, as now Stan Grof now describes it, was turning out to be the Rosetta Stone of the human psyche. Basically, the research just kept opening up. First, I was doing everybody at Esalen, all the people that were coming through Esalen, who were, you know, Esalen was such a place for powerful transformation. Some people just seemed to walk onto the property and get triggered from the morphic field. And then I started looking at historical figures, major cultural figures, like what transits did Galileo have when he turned the telescope to the heavens for the first time? You know, what transits did Rosa Parks have when she refused to get up from the bus seat and sort of catalyze the civil rights movement. What did Freud have when he, as he put it later, the secret of dreams was revealed to Dr. Sigmund Freud on July 14th, 1895. Just to look the consistency with which the transits, that is, where the planets were in the sky relative to where they were at the person's birth, correlated with the quality of experience was just stunning. And then eventually the research came to include like just the larger, the big historical cycles, like what was going on for the whole world during the 1960s when everybody who lived through it knew that something was different about this epoch from anything that they'd known before or after. And to see that the same alignments that were going on in the sky then, the planetary archetypes involved, were identical to what people were getting as individual transits when they had major experiences of breakthrough, rebellion, creative innovation, turmoil, and awakenings, and so forth. And these are called world transits, when the outer planets come into major like conjunctions or oppositions in the sky, that the same two planets that were in configuration at the time of the 60s were also in alignment during the French Revolutionary epoch from 1787 to 1798, and the same energies were in the air, the same impulse to make the world new, to the revolutionary turmoil and so forth, social, political, artistic, even a sexual revolution that happened then. So tomorrow I'll go into much more detail, but to just make a couple concluding remarks now and then take a few minutes break, and then we'll come together for any question, answer, discussion that we might want to have. But at the end of this now 30 years, I basically wrote Passion of the Western Mind, which is this history of Western thought, from the ancient Greeks to the postmodern period. I was mainly known for that, still am in a way, to the extent that I'm known at all. In the academic world, it's used in, many, many universities. I stopped counting after 100 as a text in, history of philosophy courses, history of Western civilization courses, and so forth. But I actually wrote it as a preparation for and a foundation for Cosmos and Psyche, because I knew I needed to build a foundation. People never believe the evidence that's in Cosmos and Psyche unless, first of all, some credibility had been established by the messenger, and secondly, some conceptual preparation too, like what is the nature of archetypes? Because Jung brought that term into widespread use, but it goes back to the Platonic tradition, and it meant something different for the Platonic philosophical tradition, because archetypes were cosmic. They were the fundamental principles of reality itself. By the time Jung comes, they become psychological fundamentals until the later years when he starts to, break open that understanding. Well, that's the development of modernity, to see that we live in a disenchanted universe, and then the human subject becomes the repository of these archetypes rather than reality itself. So I felt people needed to get that development. We needed to get a better understanding of the Copernican Revolution and so forth. So I set all that out. But then all along I was writing Cosmos and Psyche, and I started teaching so much that it postponed the completion of Cosmos and Psyche that contained a sufficient amount of evidence. It's about less than 1% of less than like 1/100 of 1% of the research, but it's at least it gives us enough substance to there's enough evidence there that people can come to their own conclusions about it. I now believe that, and this is something that I know Stan Grof feels the same way, that psychologists of the future and psychology textbooks of the future will look back on psychologists of the 20th century working without the aid of astrology as being very much like us medieval astronomers who were working without the aid of the telescope. And it is so valuable a tool. It is so, those of you who work with astrology know that like one good astrology reading can be as helpful as 6 months of therapy, of analysis. Which is why Jung was using it so right at the beginning to kind of cut through to what's going on right now. I also think that historians of the future will look back on historians working without the aid of astrology as lacking something as fundamental as astronomers not having the telescope. It is so extraordinary an instrument. It is not for concrete prediction. It's not like, doesn't tell you things like, on July 8th, 2009, you're going to meet and fall in love with somebody on this beach in Waikiki that you're going to, marry or whatever. I mean, it's not like that. It's archetypally predictive. It's not concretely predictive. And because archetypes are multivalent, and this was essential to Jung's understanding of archetypes. They're symbolic structures with great multiplicity, multidimensionality of meaning. It's there that human freedom has space to live out and enact those archetypal energies that are going to come through one way or another. But how they come through is, to a crucial extent, up to us and what consciousness we bring to it and what unconsciousness we bring to it will also play a big role. But a skillful use of astrology can enhance the amount of consciousness one brings to the encounter with these archetypes. Well, you become a more conscious, intelligent participant in the co-creative expression or manifestation of the archetypal complexes. So I now it's interesting. This is the Jungian. Over the years, I've lectured at many Jungian institutes, but about other aspects of Jung's work. And different people noticed from the beginning that Passion of the Western Mind was written in a way that was a history of Western thought that was informed by adept psychology and Jungian perspective. So over the years, I've lectured at many Jungian institutes, but suddenly, since Cosmos and Psyche has come out, various Jungian societies and institutes, like the San Francisco one and Portland and Washington and Aranos now, this last summer and again next summer, has invited me to speak about this part of Jung's work and the archetypal astrological perspective, because I think we are now in a position that Jung wasn't in 50 years ago. We've got much more data, much better data. We have a much better grasp of the meanings of the and significance of the outer planetary archetypes. We have computers, historical information, accurate birth data about so many cultural figures, and so forth, that simply wasn't available. And we have the capacity to track the planetary cycles way back in history to several thousand years. All this gives us a foundation, both in terms of data and in terms of technical understanding, that can allow us to start using astrology and talking about it more publicly. The evidence is just there in a way it wasn't before. And finally, we're at a whole different moment of history. And the postmodern era has unfolded. A shift in the epistemological assumptions of our time has been taking place for decades in such a way that there's a lot more openness to the mystery of being. And Shakespeare's "There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy" is much more. Many people have basically opened up to the fact that we're not intellectual masters of the universe, and in fact, it's an unending mystery that we can perhaps better approach through a epistemologically modest reverence for. I love that sign I once saw outside of California. Experiment endlessly and keep humble. And so even this most humble of traditions, of perspectives, of superstitions, this most ridiculed and ludicrous of perspectives, that it should have such illuminating power is, in a way, one more testament to the trickster playfulness of the cosmos, and another form of Jung's called or not called, the divine will come. So let's take a 10-12 minute break, and then we'll come back for a few minutes of discussion and comments.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.